This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
This is Keeping the Faith, and as sometimes happens on live radio shows, our guest has not been able to, we've not been able to connect with our guest. We're scheduled to talk with Dr. Todd Farley, who has a nationally known mime ministry, by phone, and we've not been able to reach him in spite of his confirming this by email and several emails, actually. But we're going to continue to try to get Todd Farley to talk with us and speak with us about his mime ministry. But in the meantime, we're going to be sharing with you an archive program, a very interesting one, where we were talking with the then Poet Laureate of the United States, Ted Kooser, who was in our studio a while back. If we do connect with our scheduled guest, Todd Farley, we will go to that.
Then lifts her long white fingers, letting them float, then bends again to strike just as the chair slows, as if into a silence. So expertly she plays the chords of this difficult music she has mastered, her wet face beautiful in its concentration, while the wind turns the pages of rain.
This was a reading of A Rainy Morning by the author, Ted Kooser, from his recent book, The Lights and Shadows, published by Copper Canyon Press, and read on the air by permission of the poet as well as the publisher. Ted, you do these kind of readings all the time. How do you pick what poems to read to different audiences in different settings?
Well, I've discovered over the years many of my poems are really too short for public readings. They go by the audience so quickly.
Just
that
too fast.
Yeah, too fast. Robert Bly, when he reads a short poem, reads it twice,
uh-huh.
And I've tried that a few times. But generally a longer poem seems to work better with an audience. There are other things that you want to do when you're doing a reading. You know, it's good to let the audience laugh every once in a while a little bit to take the tension off. Otherwise, the readings can get pretty deadly without that.
And some of your poems are very funny.
Well, yeah, there is some humor in some of them, yeah. And, you know, that sort of thing. You know, you just sort of – and also when I – if I'm not really reading from a prepared list, I very often watch people in the audience and see how it's going and see if I can guess what poems might, you know, work better with that group.
Now, you work very carefully in your writing to use words that are clear and simple and usually short. Usually,
yeah.
One or two syllables.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unusual poem of yours, as I've read them, that has four and five syllable words in it.
You
prefer the kind of language that people use every day.
Yes, I do extensive revision in writing. A short poem like this Rainy Morning might have gone through 30, 40, even 50 revisions, and all of my revisions are done with an eye of revising toward clarity and simplicity and away from difficulty, which is somewhat contrary to the way current poetics are. But my idea is that the finished poem ought to look as if it was just effortless, as if I just wrote it in a single gesture. And you know, big words are kind of intimidating, I think.
And by choosing not to use the Latin-based words that show up in the English language and focusing more on, I guess, Anglo-Saxon tradition, it gives your work a certain style. I mean, a certain. I think if I saw one of your poems and didn't know who'd written it, I might well guess you.
Well, Latinisms are not. You know, as far as the sound, they're not as interesting in sound. I mean, Anglo-Saxon words, of course, are marvelous. I'm not making those choices consciously,
uh-huh.
though. You know, I'm choosing words that, you know, at some level that just please me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But, you know, a good old word like oak, I mean, there's nothing better than that, you know.
And in this case, talking about a young woman in a wheelchair, described with just words like black nylon poncho, spattered with rain, pushing herself through the morning. It's clear, and yet it's mysterious.
Mm-hmm,
Mm-hmm. I often get a sense of mystery in your poems.
Well, it's mystery, but it's also, I think, awe and enchantment. Mm-hmm. I'm taken with this person, you know, mm-hmm. and see a sort of special something about that person.
Now you introduced this poem by saying you often respond to characters, to people, to settings, to things, to events, and that causes you to write about them. But how much of it is fictional? How much of it is made up? I mean,
well, of course, the metaphor in this poem is a creation of mine. The woman was actually there. I saw the woman and I saw her hands doing this way. And so what I did was I tried to play with that experience by bringing the metaphor into it.
Of music, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Many critics who have responded to your work have seen this gift you have of those kind of metaphors that are both clear and ambiguous, deep as well as seemingly simple, as very unusual. When did you first realize you could do that?
Well, you know, I think I have been extremely lucky to have a gift for that sort of thing. I work with graduate students at the University of Nebraska, and there are some who can't come up with metaphor unless it's very willful and calculated, and they always feel that way, you know, to me. It's better for a poet like that to avoid it altogether, I think, you know. It just happens that I am of a sort of mind that those things are, you know, relatively just below the surface. And
how early in your life did you begin to write?
Well, I wrote poems when I was in third and fourth grade, poems and
young.
So on, yeah.
Huh.
We had, you know, I had a really good teacher and fourth grade particularly. And then when I got to be an adolescent, I got more serious about it. And,
what was your first published poem?
It was in a... There was a teenage magazine called Dig, and
I remember it.
Yeah, it was a ballad about a hot rod race that I wrote. I was a hot rodder when I was in high school, and it was, you know, it was typical two hot rods racing, you know, that kind of thing, in a kind of a Robert Service ballad form. Hmm. Yeah, 16 years old.
Okay. And when you went to college, you were telling me earlier that you started off in architecture. What appealed to you about that?
Well, actually, I don't know what really appealed to me, but high school counseling in those days wasn't very sophisticated. When I got to be my senior year in high school, my advisor called me in and he said, "Now, Ted, you can draw, can't you?" And I said, "Yes, I like to draw." He said, "There are two things you can be. You can be an art teacher or an architect." And I said, "Well, I guess I'll be an architect." Huh. You know, so I wound up in architecture school. But at Iowa State, architecture school was mostly engineering. Mm-hmm. And I did all right through the drawing courses and everything until it came to the engineering courses, and then I was no good. And my Deachin slide rule is out in the middle of Lake Laverne on the campus at Iowa State. I threw it out there on the day I walked out.
What did you switch to?
I switched to something at that time. It was called distributed studies. Iowa State, you know, didn't have a liberal arts program. Iowa U had the liberal arts program at that time. And, you know, distributed studies was a way of getting me a teaching certificate in English, so, yeah.
Now, where did you grow up in Iowa?
In Ames.
In Ames.
Yeah,
your hometown.
Yeah.
And when you went to graduate school right after that, or did you?
I taught high school one year after I got out of Iowa State, in a little town in Iowa. And then went to graduate school in Nebraska because Carl Shapiro, who had won the Pulitzer Prize, was at Nebraska, and I wanted to study with him. And then what happened was that I did that for a year, and I spent all my time with Carl, mm-hmm. Socially and otherwise. And so they threw me out of the graduate program because I didn't do anything else. And I had to find something to do, so I went to work for an insurance company, sort of an entry-level job, and never left. You know, I worked for two companies for 35 years.
And that was in Lincoln?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And you ended up as a vice president, specializing in what, or overseeing what?
Well, at the end of my insurance years, I was in charge of the public relations department, which included designing sales brochures and writing newsletters and that sort of thing. Yeah.
But you started off as a sales...
Well, I started off answering letters from policyholders who wanted to change their beneficiaries and things. And then I was a medical underwriter for about 25 years.
Wow.
And then a president of the company realized that I had some skills that could be used in the marketing department, so they moved me over there in public relations.
And how did you find time to write, make time to write?
Well, I got up every morning at 4:30 and wrote till about 7, till I had to get my necktie on. Huh. And I still get up at that hour. Huh. Yeah.
And would you write in a particular place?
Well, winter and summer are different places, but usually the same. You know, and there are chairs that I like to sit in and, you know, quiet spots and so on.
Hmm. Location seems to matter a great deal to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Matter of fact, all this traveling is that I've been doing as the Poet Laureate is very disconcerting to me because I'm away from my routines and my dogs and my wife and my, you know, all my belongings and my books and so on.
Now, you write about all those things in poetry, and you've also recently published a book called Local Wonders, which is, what is it? Is it prose? Is it poetry? What is it?
Well, there's some poems in there disguised as prose, quite a few, actually. Uh-huh. But yeah, they're short, sort of meditative essays, I guess. And the book, you know, it's about where we live in Nebraska, and... When they originally accepted this book for publication, the acting director of the press at that time said, you know, we think this will sell okay locally, but we're not sure how it'll do nationally. And, of course, it's done very well nationally.
And recently it's just out in paperback? Or, no, 2002 was in paperback.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It came out in 2000.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was soon after... Your first bout with cancer, is that right?
Well, I got ill in mid 1998 and had surgery. It was oral cancer. Had surgery and then radiation. So by the end of the year, I was kind of starting to come out of it. And I wrote one little book called Winter Morning Walks: 100 Postcards to Jim Harrison out of that experience. I was working on these other things at the same time. Local Wonders sort of came together. I had a lot of little essays that I'd written over many years, and I finally started moving them together, you know. And, yeah.
Tell our listeners about Jim Harrison.
Well, he has a very gruff exterior, and he's one of the loveliest, most generous, nicest guys in the world. I love him dearly. He's a marvelous guy.
How'd you meet him?
He was working on a novel called Dalva that... It's set in Nebraska, in the Nebraska Sandhills. And he was working, he would come out to Nebraska and spend time in the State Historical Society archives looking at boxes of photographs, shuffling through boxes of photographs for inspiration. And the photo curator was an acquaintance of mine, and he got us together. I don't know how, frankly, I don't remember how many years ago this was, 15 maybe? Yeah.
And the book you've done together, tell us about that.
Well, that was the result of Jim and an exchange of poems over many years back and forth. We had all these little poems that we'd stuck in letters to each other and so on, and we decided we'd try to arrange them into a book, and it came out, you know. What happened was I had all these things. I put them on 3x5 cards, and I had two strings of them about 40 feet long, and kept moving them around till I could get a rhythm through the thing and so on. Of course, the poems are not attributed to either of us.
Why is that?
Well, for several reasons, really. I didn't think it was, both of us agreed on this. It didn't seem like a good idea to stop a three-line poem and have a name and then have another three-line poem and another name and so on. But also... we were making a statement about, you know, the idea of celebrity in writing, and, you know, it isn't the poems are what really count, not the names, you know, and so on.
Of course, you'll drive future graduate students crazy.
Yeah, there are plenty of people that, you know, stop me and say, now, could you just tell me if maybe that one was yours, and you know, and so on. So
let's talk a little bit about celebrity. Being a poet laureate, of course, gives you a nationwide audience that perhaps you didn't have before. How's that affected your life?
Completely. it stopped me in my tracks as a writer, I'll tell you that. You know, I haven't had time to write anything. I was so completely flabbergasted by this. I had absolutely no idea this was coming. I just got a phone call out of the blue. I gathered that they'd been looking at me for a couple of years, but, you know, very covertly. It was a complete surprise. And I was so surprised and so flummoxed on the telephone that the man who called me said, well, you know, I think I better call you back tomorrow. You know?
Let you know it's really true.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with the current Poet Laureate of the United States, Ted Couser. That last name is spelled K-O-O-S-E-R. And he's read one poem already from his most recent book, Delights and Shadows, published by Copper Canyon Press. And that came out just this year, 2004. And could we ask you to read another?
Sure. This poem is, again, typical of the kind of thing I do with metaphor, where I take off from an initiating subject and go let the metaphor just sort of balloon away and then try to tug it back. Bank fishing for bluegills. A breeze nudges the empty aluminum boat as it drifts at the end of its rope, its lightness wallowing within it, like a fat man who has fished all day and fallen asleep and is dreaming of when he was a little boy and weighed no more than a plastic bucket. Years of floating alone, fishing far from the tourist cabins shining like rivets along the water's edge, have bleached the blue from his overalls and denim shirt. His face has the flat gray sheen of a man with a failing heart, but he is all lightness now and tethered only gently to this world. I would guess that readers almost forget that it's a boat and, you know, moves so far into the man, you know, mm-hmm. So I have to bring it back at the mm-hmm. end, you know. Yeah.
We've just heard Bank Fishing for Bluegills, read by the author Ted Couser from his book Delights and Shadows, read by permission of the author and Copper Canyon Press. When you write a poem like this, you say you often revise it many, many times. Can you ever date poems? I mean, do you remember them as to how old you were or where you were when you wrote them?
Oh, sure, some of them, yeah, uh-huh. yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That one, you know, I remember this, you know, being about 5 years ago, really, mm-hmm. when I wrote this one song. Mm-hmm. But.
And when you pull together a collection, how far back do you go? Do you have a whole...
Well, this collection is about 10 years.
Okay.
Which would mean that I have about 6 poems a year to keep. Hmm. The collection like this before this was Weather Central is 1994, so we have a good 10 years. Uh-huh. It used to be that I would do it in like 7 or 8. Now it seems to be stretching out a little bit more. I think I'm more particular than I used to be about my books.
So you mentioned that Local Wonders, this collection of essays and prose poems, stretched out even longer than that. But when you were pulling it together and making a book out of it, were you able to be writing sort of standard, your favorite kind of poems at the same time?
Well, sometimes, yeah. Oh. Yeah. What happened with the Local Wonders was that I had been writing these little essays for many, many years and just sticking them in folders and so on. And I had read a book by Hal Borland called Sundial of the Seasons, which is a book of Borland's columns, actually, but arranged by season. And I thought, well, you know, many of these pieces that I've written say something about the weather or the season, and let's just see what happens. So I set them up in 4 piles and began kind of dealing them into 4 piles, and all of a sudden I realized that I had something there, you know, that there was an order there that I had not ever thought about. And then, of course, I began to write transitional things and bring other, you know, write other pieces for it and so on. And
Well, it's a wonderful collection. And I see we have a caller already. Let's go to one of the local lines. Line number 1. Yes, go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I wanted to ask this particular poet about art and politics. There's nothing inherent in poetry, I don't think, that makes it political. But there's a long tradition of people who want to examine the human spirit to also examine the human condition from a variety of ways. And I'm recollecting, I think, that the last inaugural didn't feature a poet. It was the first one since Kennedy inviting Frost at his inaugural for there not to be a poet intervention. Maybe that's gratuitous, but I was also just thinking of the imbroglio about the poets not going to the being disinvited from the White House because they were going to. It was in the lead up to the war. One remembers back, and so I'm just reflecting on that at this time. And since we're coming to another inaugural, I don't know whether you've been invited yet, or whether you'd think that would be appropriate, or just. I think I'll hang up and go on with a day and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I don't remember the Republicans ever having a poet read at an inauguration. I think I may be completely wrong about that, but it seems to me that that's been a thing for Democrats to do, and that the Republicans might not do it because the Democrats have done it always. If I were asked to which I think is probably your question, if I were asked to read at the inauguration, what would I do? And I'm really hoping that I would not be asked. Occasional poems are almost always dreadful, and I really don't want to make a fool of myself in front of the entire nation by writing an occasional poem that's no good. So I'm hoping it does not happen.
We have a couple other callers waiting. Let's go to a listener on line two. You're on the air with Ted Kooser. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm so thrilled with this poem. And also, I'm a fisherman myself, so the last poem you read, I loved. I'm an RN. I'm 68 years old, and I write sometimes. I wanted you to explain more in detail about the role of metaphor. How do you make it clear and ambiguous? I do that sometimes myself. Also, I wondered if you needed to suffer to write. And I'll hang up and listen off the air. And thank you so much for being in Champaign-Urbana.
Well, thank you. I'm not really sure that I understand. I've never tried to really be too analytical with metaphor. It seems like such a lucky thing that maybe it's better not to examine it too much. I as I said, I'm very lucky to have to be kind of tuned into that. And let's see.
Suffering was the question, yes. And that may not be a good thing for you to respond to, since you have a toothache as we speak.
Well, the idea of the suffering artist is a sort of a romantic, exaggerated thing, and I don't think. I think works of art are occasions for joy and affirmation. Even the darkest poem is a kind of an affirmation. And sure, there are plenty of poets who suffer in their lives and everything, but I don't think that's required by any means. I know plenty of artists who have had blissfully happy childhoods, as I did.
And yet you titled this most recent collection, or did you title it Delights and Shadows, or was that the publisher?
Yeah, no, that was my title,
okay.
Yeah.
But the shadows is part of it.
Of course, yeah. That's just, it's part of life, yeah.
Let's go to another caller who's waiting on line three. You're on the air.
Hello. Would you please discuss your forthcoming book on creative writing? I think the title is something like The Beginning Poet's Home Repair Factory?
Well, that's close. A pretty good try. It's called The Poetry Home Repair Manual.
Oh, thank you.
And what it is, it's things that I've thought about, in teaching over some years. And it is not a manual of technical things like, there are lots of manuals that show you how to write a sonnet and how to write a sestina and so on. It's nothing like that. I do talk about it form a little bit, but mostly as it is used for effects of one kind or another. I'm very much a believer in thinking about readers as we write. And the book puts a lot of emphasis on thinking about what your audience's expectations may be and that sort of thing. I don't know, I don't know how helpful it'll be to people. I hope it's of some help. I wouldn't see anything wrong if everyone in the world were writing poems. I'd like to encourage that, thinking of what they usually do with their time. You know, that wouldn't be anything wrong with that as far as I'm concerned.
That's a book coming out next spring, University of Nebraska Press, The Poetry Home Repair Manual by Ted Kooser. So that's all finished.
It's done, yeah.
Yeah, it's at the press.
Yeah.
Okay. Will that be hardback, paperback?
Paper, I think they may do a small hardcover edition. Most of these presses do that for library sales, you
I
know.
See.
But,
uh-huh.
but yeah, they primarily paperback, yeah.
Okay. And after having been named Poet Laureate of the United States, are there publishers who are now bringing back some of the things that might have been out of print from your earlier collections?
Well, the University of Pittsburgh Press, I had two books, actually three books from them, but the first two, Sure Signs in 1980 and One World at a Time in 1985, they are combining into one book called Flying at Night, which is named after one of the poems in the second book. And, you know, some of the I've taken out a few of them, you know, probably 15, 20 poems out of both books for that book, and that'll be coming out. The University of Nebraska Press is publishing a limited edition of a memoir I wrote about my mother's family up in northeastern Iowa as a sort of a little gift book to give donors of the university. I don't know whether that'll ever be a trade book or not, some things like that, you know. You have to be very careful, though, once you achieve, you know, become a poet laureate or something like that, because everybody wants to publish your poems, and you have to be very careful not to publish a lot of really awful poems.
I see.
So I haven't sent anything out and don't intend to for a while.
We're about halfway through our program. We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Ted Kooser, that's spelled K-O-O-S-E-R, who was born in Iowa, Ames, and ended up in Nebraska for graduate school, stayed there I guess ever since.
That's right. Yeah.
And currently live in a small town of, what, 300 or so?
Well, we actually don't live even in the small town. We are about 2 miles away from it. Our mailing address is Garland, Nebraska, which is 227 on Sunday morning when everybody's still in bed. You know?
And you're on 60-some acres, as I remember reading.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
We could describe Local Wonders as almost a biography, autobiography. Would you say that about it?
Well, it's certainly that way in that I talk a lot about what I'm doing with my days. And then there, of course,
you talk about your family.
I do talk about my family a lot, yeah.
And it's dedicated to your son, Jeff?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remind listeners that support for these programs is provided in part by the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest student organization on campus. It was started by students back in 1873, and since that time has been finding ways to develop student leadership by providing opportunities for social action and community service. Well, let's get back to our guest, Ted Kooser. We've given him a chance to clear his throat and have a little sip of water, and maybe we could ask you to read another poem.
Sure. Let's try Turkey Vultures. I had noticed that if you look up at a turkey vulture while it's in flight, the ends of the wing feathers fan out like fingers, and that's the initiating thing for this poem, Turkey Vultures. Circling above us, their wingtips fanned like fingers. It is as if they were smoothing one of those tissue paper sewing patterns over the pale blue fabric of the air, touching the heavens with leisurely pleasure, just a word or two called back and forth, taking all the time in the world, even though the sun is low and red in the west, and they have fallen behind with the making of shrouds.
thinking of vultures, turkey vultures, read by Ted Kooser, the current poet laureate of the United States, who's here in the studio in Champaign this weekend with us. Tell us a little bit about the form of your poems. This one is in two-line groupings until the last single line. How do you decide what form to put your ideas in?
Well, I think the stanza break is a way of giving a little extra breathing room. You know, it's a matter of pacing more than anything else. You know, I try to fit the form to whatever I'm, you know, doing in that particular poem, rather than trying to write a whole book with three-line stanzas, that sort of thing. That becomes very mannered and labored, I think. And also the stanzas don't seem to have any integrity as units of speech and so on that way. It's the attempt to try to fit the form to the whatever I'm trying to do with the poem. John Berger, who's an English writer, writer on art and a novelist, said one time that in the best works of art, the form should seem inevitable. And that would be a goal that, you know, anybody would try for, I would think, you know.
Now, in this case, the poem is one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And divided up the way it is so that the eye sees this pattern. You're also talking about patterns of these birds.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, ending with the phrase, with the making of shrouds, having fallen behind with the making of shrouds. Shadows, Delights in Shadows is the title of this collection. What kind of shadows have been in your life that find expression in your writing?
Well, loss, certainly, and mutability. You know, I miss my ancestors terribly. You know, I think about them. I don't know whether this is normal for a person or not, but not a day goes by that at some moment I don't review all those people, you know, and just think of, kind of check in with them in memory a little bit, you know. It's an inescapable thing to lose one's parents and grandparents and so on, but I want to keep them alive kind of through memory. Matter of fact, that little book I mentioned the University Press is going to do as a gift book about my mother's family was really written as she was dying, as a gift for her, but also as an attempt for me of keeping a group of rather ordinary people alive just a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
My granddad ran a gas station. My grandmother kept house. That sort of thing. They were the kind of people you'd drive by and never think about, you know, but they were very special to me, and I wanted to do something with them that would keep them going, you know.
And in your book, Local Wonders, Seasons in the Bohemian Alps, and we'll explain that in just a moment, but Local Wonders, you write very movingly about your mother and your father.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, they seemed to me to be quite remarkable people, you know, but I would guess everyone's parents are, you know, to some degree. The Bohemian Alps in that title comes from, we live in an area in Nebraska that was eroded because of there was a finger of the glacier there, and the water stood against it as it melted off, and it eroded out these hills. And they're called the Bohemian Alps because there were a lot of Bohemians who settled there in the late 19th century and who are still there. But it's, you know, it's a tongue-in-cheek thing, and the hills are no more than 100 feet from the bottom to the top, you know, so.
When did you first move there?
We've lived out there a little over 20 years now. Yeah.
And what do you do with your 60-some acres?
Well, nothing really. You know, we just let the wildlife have it pretty much. We have some native grass that, you know, that's being cared for a little bit, but generally it's natural country.
Now, some of the anger in your books comes toward people who don't appreciate nature. You have some nasty things to say about policies made by, say, county commissioners in your area about
oh, yeah.
what they do to...
They can be real yahoos for sure, yeah. We have... I'm always, you know, having been a, for one thing, having been a cancer patient, you know, you're pretty sensitive about chemicals and that sort of thing. And these guys will spray every living thing, you know. They love to ride along in the back of a truck with a hose, just squirting everything in sight with herbicide, you know. It's crazy. And they say they do it to keep the plum thickets from causing snow to drift over the road, but once the leaves are gone, the thicket is still there. It still arrests the wind and causes that, you know. But I don't know that there's anything to be done about it other than the kind of shouting that I've done about it, you know.
And other concerns that you have in your writing, since this show talks about ethical issues, you talk about how people mistreat other people also.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of a specific instance right now where I'm doing that. But
I'm not asking you to name names.
Yeah.
But when there's neglect, it clearly raises emotions that you've expressed in your poetry.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I, you know, I was raised among rather pretty common people, and one of the things that I really detest about our country is classism and elitism, and it seems to be everywhere. I assume that's because we have this European heritage, and we just can't stand to have a democratic country. We want to have layers of class and so on, and I just detest that. There was a woman wrote me from a... who'd been to a writer's conference last summer, and they were talking about poetry in public places, poems on buses and so on. And she said that a young poet from Yale on the panel said, "Why would I want someone who rides a bus reading my poems?" Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And we have someone on line one. You're on the air with poet laureate Ted Kooser.
Hi. I called before, but my question is, how do you prevent nostalgia? I mean, I'm... Obviously, I think of my folks every day, and I'm from a small town, and I tend to be an old fogey. Anyway, how do you prevent nostalgia? And then I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thanks.
Well, you know, I'm an old fogey, too. And I think nostalgia is a perfectly legitimate human emotion. I mean, we all feel it. There's nothing wrong with that. Sentimentality is another thing, and that is that basically what that a better way of looking at that would be to call it gushiness. Most of us know when we're kind of gushing about something, and that's the kind of thing you want to prevent. Writing with some restraint away from gushiness, I think, is wise, because you don't want to. Readers are sensitive to that kind of thing. They know when they're being manipulated by language that is meant to kind of elicit a feeling from them and so on. Mainly it's just being honest with our feelings and not being too general either. You know, you can't... There's nothing to be said for writing, "Those were the good old days." You know, everybody can say that, and that is that kind of general language is not very effective in writing. You need to show why the good old days. What was one incident of the good old days being good, and so on. I hope that's helpful. I'm not sure.
Who were some of the people that influenced you? You mentioned earlier Carl Shapiro that you studied with, but who else that you have read made a difference in how you thought about things and how you saw the limits of sentiment and how much is appropriate and where it goes over the line?
Well, you know, I have learned from every poem I've ever read, I think, and that's why I really emphasize it, how important it is to read, particularly for young poets starting out. You have to read. They should be reading 50 poems for every one they try to write, reading carefully, you know, because you learn from the mistakes that people make as well as the good things. And, you know, reading is really essential along those lines. My earliest, I was thinking the other day, trying to remember the books that I bought quite early on. One of the very early books was a book by Mae Swenson that really affected me. Mae Swenson is really quite a marvelous poet. She's been dead for a number of years. I liked her work immensely. They did a posthumous collection here about 5 or 6 years ago called Nature, which is a book of her, all of her nature poems. It's quite a thick book, but it's quite marvelous. I read a lot of William Carlos Williams, you know, the modern poets and so on. I read a little Ezra Pound and some Eliot and so on, like everybody else in graduate school did, but I was never really as taken with them as the other poets.
Hmm. When you were talking about your teaching, when did you first begin teaching poetry or teaching English literature? You taught once.
Well, I taught high school for 1 year.
1 year of high school.
And then during the years that I was working for the insurance company, I would occasionally be asked to teach a night course in, like, beginning poetry writing. Mm-hmm. And I did that as a, sort of an adjunct. Mm-hmm. And then when I retired after I recovered from my illness and retired, the English department asked me if I'd come down and do a little more teaching on a kind of visiting professor basis. My preferred means of teaching, and it usually works out, is to take a seminar of a dozen students and not have any class sessions at all, meet each student for an hour in my office a week, and we just get together and talk about their work. They bring whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. And in that way, if they're writing prose, that's fine. If they're writing poetry, that's fine. We'll just talk about whatever they brought in, and it's worked out quite well, I think. Mm-hmm.
When you mentioned earlier sonnets, I noticed some of your poems have the 12 lines, 14 lines, excuse me, and have certain rhyme patterns, although not traditional meters, and not a regular rhyme, not even, you know, half rhymes, and yet those sounds... patterns I see in many of the poems. Do you set out when you start to create that, or is that a happy accident?
I think most of it is a happy accident. Mm-hmm. Students who went through the years, the Kennedy years, when the speed reading was the thing to do, who read words from as ideas, and there's no stage at which they can feel the words in their mouths. Don't have much luck with that kind of thing. But I learned to read in such a way that I hear every word or taste every word that's in my mouth. And as a result, I can't read a page of prose any faster than I could say it out loud and read it out loud. Mm. And as a result of that, I have these sounds that, you know, that I hear them and I'm charmed by ways that the sounds put together, you know, and so on. So, yeah, happy accident. Some of it, you know, I go back and fine-tune a little bit. Usually the other way, though, to take the stuff out that's a little bit too noisy, you know, yeah. Hmm.
Hmm. How do you know when a poem is finished?
Well, Auden said we just abandon them eventually, you know. I think that I try to give them time to age and put them aside and then look at them again after a few weeks and so on and see if they still have some life to them and... oftentimes they don't, you know, it's hard to say, you know, I guess I'm done when I can't think of anything else to do to make them better.
Now your book Local Wonders, is part of an American Live series edited by Tobias Wolf. How have editors affected your writing?
Well, I've actually been pretty fortunate with editors. Magazine editors, of course, over the years, you know, picking and choosing my poems have taught me a lot about, that sort of thing. My editor at the University of Nebraska Press, a woman named Ladette Randolph, who runs this American Live series, a fine editor, and has really published some really good books in that series. Both my book and Floyd Skloot's book, which came out this year, the title escapes me right now. Both of them were Barnes & Noble Discover Award winners and so on, you know.
What was your first award?
I think it was an award when I was a graduate student at Nebraska, you know. I remember my first wife and I bought we got a $400 check as a prize, and we
enjoyed that $400.
we went out and bought a rug, and then we had a big party, and somebody got a pizza all over it. I remember that. Yeah,
we had the state of Illinois poet laureate as a guest on this program a couple weeks ago, Kevin Stein, and it seems clear that those kind of awards, there are not many of them for poetry, mm-hmm. for one thing, mm-hmm. But when they come, they sure can encourage a writer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You said you might be willing to read something to us from Local Wonders.
Sure.
I realize some of those essays are longer than the poems you've been reading, but is there a short one that comes to mind that might give listeners just a sense of this prose book?
Well, you know, I read that poem about turkey vultures, and just opening the book, I just opened to the little passage about turkey vultures here. It's pretty short. I just counted 27 turkey vultures perched in the trees at the head of our pond, taking the early morning sun, a few holding their wings open as if to air them like soiled bedding after a long winter, others lazily shifting from branch to branch, their weight slightly altering the white shapes of the dead trees as they settle. Gray-brown feathers like ash, little red heads like lumps of innards. If we were looking for one word to describe them, it would be patience. The turkey vulture is never in a hurry. What it wants will come to it in time. 2 years ago in late spring, when Kathleen drove me home from the hospital after my cancer surgery, we came up over a hill about a mile from our house, and they were waiting, maybe 50 turkey vultures sitting on fence posts along the road, standing in the grass just over the fence. Uh-oh, I thought. They've been waiting for me. I might as well get out and lie down at the edge of the road. As they moved about on the ground, they occasionally opened and then beat down their wings, lifting them just slightly off the ground, as if to say, I can fly if I feel like it, but I don't feel like it just yet. There would be plenty of time for flying later. For the time being, we're waiting, just working our wings a little and slowly turning our heads and showing off the red fists of our heads and our bright yellow eyes that can see right straight through human hope.
And yet in your writing, you've chosen hope.
Absolutely, yeah.
In your life, you've chosen hope.
Yeah. I think that, and I guess I may have said this earlier, that every work of art is a work of affirmation. I find it extremely difficult to read the writing of people who have killed themselves, for instance. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say that I'm put off by it. I'm sympathetic with them, everything, but that is such a denial of everything that I stand for.
Hmm. And how much of that comes from your parents?
I suppose quite a bit. You know, it's very hard to say the kind of influence, but my parents were, you know, they loved life and believed in it and lived hard and, you know, did well, I think.
Hmm. How did you combine being a businessman with being a poet? It seems almost antithetical.
Well, that's been asking me a lot. You know, I don't really think that that's the case. You know, business, of course, can be criticized for being crass and so on. But it's just a business is a lot of people working together, you know, and they're just people. Pretty much. They're doing as best they can, most of them. You know, I suppose part of what goes wrong is if the governance of the business is going off in a bad direction and all the people have to line up behind it. But our company was never quite like that, you know. Life insurance, there's a purpose for it. You know, it helps people, beneficiaries and so on, you know. I'm not trying to sell it here, you know, but... But it, you know, it has some social worth, and those people subscribe to that, I think.
Mm-hmm. And are grateful for it.
I think so, yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. You have a son who lives in near Champaign-Urbana and works here. You've been here before visiting him?
Oh, yes, several times, yeah. A number of times, yeah. Uh-huh.
And does he enjoy some of the things you enjoy, your visual arts, drawing,
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. Yes, his main interest in recent years has been computers and so on. He's a computer systems manager for the Champaign newspaper. and you know, graduated from college with an emphasis in mathematics and so on. We're different in that way as far as those things, but we still appreciate the same things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Ted Kooser, who is the poet laureate for the United States. And he's been reading some of his poetry and prose. Most recently, he read from Local Wonders, Seasons in the Bohemian Alps. That is came out in paperback in 2002 after its original publication in 2000 by Bison Books. He's also been reading from Delights and Shadows, his most recent collection of poetry, published by Copper Canyon Press. I want to thank Ted for being with us today and for reading in spite of having a toothache. And
so thank you very much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For doing it. We've been listening to United States Poet Laureate Ted Kooser, a program recorded in 2004. Another poet we interviewed that year, Professor Jeannie Murray Walker of the University of Delaware, spoke also about her writing process. Let's hear a bit of that show at this time. Gene, tell us about how A Deed to the Light came to be. When did you first start writing these particular poems?
Well, these poems are collected over the last maybe 8 years. Mm-hmm. Some of them are slightly older than that. I think I do what most poets do, and that is I try to assemble a collection of poems that I've written since the last collection, and the last collection came out in 1998. It's now out of print, but the poems in each one of my volumes are fairly different from one another. So these poems, I did some revising last year before I finally put the collection together.
Now, several of these have religious themes, which make them of particular interest to listeners to this program, Keeping the Faith. Some have been published in places like the Christian Century, the Notre Dame Review. Is it Image or Image?
Image.
Spirituality and Health. But you've also been published, some of these in Prairie Schooner, Poetry, Gettysburg Review, many other places. I guess the first question I have about the poetry with religious content and images is, does that come natural to you? Is that something you have long done, or is that something fairly new?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think the whole problem of language for somebody who's a believer is difficult, because it seems to me that there's a whole world of biblical language, first of all, which I was a reader of the King James Bible when I was younger and still am. And that kind of language, of course, is not appropriate. And then there's the language of dogma, or the language of argument about our faith, or expression of faith. And I think for me, the problem with that language for many years was that it's fairly cliched. And it's taken me a long time to try to figure out how to write about the experience of somebody who's on a religious journey in ways that are not, how to say it new, how to make it new again. And I think that one of the problems is that it's not exact, the language isn't really recognizable to people who are in the religious community. The experience is, because what I'm often talking about or wrestling with are questions of forgiveness, are questions of faith and doubt, those kinds of questions, but it's not necessarily in religious language.
And I'm not sure how much of this we can quote, since I didn't get permission from Poetry Magazine to quote from your most recent poem there called Staying Power, but I think I can at least safely quote at the beginning. It says, in appreciation of Maxim Gorky at the International Convention of Atheists, 1929. Now, and yet in that poem, you're dealing with the whole issue of not only doubt, but God. I wonder how many times Poetry Magazine has had a poem in it that uses the word God. I think six times I counted.
Well, that's something, I don't know the answer to that question, but I think at the moment, Poetry Magazine is amazingly about discovering those issues and wrestling with those questions. And I think there's a new editor, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. I think he took over in October of 2003. And the magazine is about struggling with all kinds of important questions. I have the feeling that the great literature has always been about questions of doubt and belief and faith and, you know, think about Moby Dick, think about a lot of Shakespeare's plays, think about the greatest literature, Dostoevsky, for example. So I'm sort of not as surprised to see that in Poetry Magazine. Because I think that the magazine right now is really about wrestling with things that are crucial. And, you know, that leads me to say poetry is not ornamental. It's really about struggle at some level. So I don't know whether there are lots of poems that come out and say God in the way that that poem does. But I think there are a lot of poems that deal with those questions. Mm-hmm.
Could we ask you to read a poem of yours that you have copyright to and wouldn't mind sharing with a listening audience?
Yeah, I would love to. There's a poem in A Deed to the Light, which is called The Nurses. Let me just take a minute to say something about it before I start reading it. I have a friend who is now retired from nursing, but who has been a crucial figure in the setting up a lot of what goes on with children's cancer ward. She actually started in Boston probably 35 or 40 years ago, and one of her innovations was to allow parents to stay with children overnight. And one of the things that she told me was that you have to laugh, otherwise you can't go back. So The Nurses is a kind of view of Jean Ferguson and her friends from the point of view of somebody who's visiting a sick child. The Nurses. I can hear them in there laughing, the nurses on the children's cancer ward, as I walk through, my heart snagged on a child in room 206. The boat of my hopes tipping its freight into the water. Because kids in here are dying, like trees turning in the fall, so slowly that we have to dwell on each interval of suffering. The door opens a slice, and I see nurses leaning into laughter, collapsing, gripping each other's arms. Their laughter skates on air. It fills the room up. It towers above us. I shut the door. They laugh because grief adheres to them as desire adheres to beautiful women. They have to pick it from their fur. They have to help each other comb it out. They study jokes as farm girls study dresses in a catalog. They balance on a high beam of laughter, knowing if they laugh, they might come back tomorrow.
We've just heard Jean Murray Walker, the author, read her poem, The Nurses, which is this particular poem dedicated to for Jean Ferguson from her most recent book, A Deed to the Light, published by University of Illinois Press. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
This Week in This American Life, it is our 500th episode, and we are commemorating that by playing you the very best moments, and by that I mean the staff's favorite moments of the last 17 years.
As it unfolds, you just realize, like, no, 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 no.
When I heard that, I was like, well, that's one articulate bank robber.
And there's a point where he just realizes, like, oh, she loves me.
The very best moments of our show ever this week.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana. And we're streaming online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Jason Croft. Thanks for being here. Ira Glass is next with This American Life. This week, they are celebrating their 500th episode with producers from the show talking about their favorite moments. Then at 7 o'clock, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Keep your radio tuned here to AM 580.